Well, it's 2015, and I want to wish you a happy new year. These are the days when resolutions are formed. Oh yes, if you check your email inbox, the Groupons have been encouraging you towards New Year's resolutions, the Living Social, maybe some of your friends if you've gone back to work. Perhaps you've resolved some things this year. I'm not going to embarrass you and ask you what your resolution is, but I wonder how many of you have resolved to do something this year? How many of you? Don't be ashamed. I have. Sometimes lasts a week or two, but I give it a whirl. Someone reminded me, actually, Courtney Howell, reminded me of my resolution last year. It was about dieting, portion control. I made it through January. Listen, you know what's good about resolutions? You just make them again next year. You just start again. Maybe you've resolved to exercise or diet or read through the Bible this year. Maybe you've had a resolution about saving some money or paying off a credit card. Maybe you've resolved to work on a tenuous relationship or to seek by God's grace to conquer a besetting sin. Maybe you've resolved something this year. But resolutions are funny things, because when you really think about what resolutions are, what they do is they point out our weaknesses and our deficiencies, don't they? I mean, just think for a second about what you're resolving to do. Well, the reason you're resolving to do or start or accomplish something is because it's lacking or undone in your life. So the funny thing about resolutions is that they kind of point out some of the gaps in our lives. And I've often thought about some of those people that seem to have it all together. I mean, what do they resolve to do? You know, so you got this person, they got all this money. Well, they're not resolving to pay off their credit card. They don't have to worry about that. Or you see this person that is fit and trim and like, and you're like, they're not resolving to diet. They've got it all under control. You see these people who are disciplined readers of the Bible. They're not resolving. I mean, they've already read it through four times from last year. I mean, you're like, what are these people that seem to have it all together? I mean, what did they resolve? You know, when I started thinking about that, I was reminded of a man who at first glance seemed to have it all together. And I wondered, what would he resolve? He's a king from the past, a king that seemed to have everything you'd ever want. What does a guy like that resolve on New Year's? Do you know who I'm talking about? His name is King Solomon, a guy who at first glance seems to have everything. And the reason I'm bringing up Solomon is because he's the writer of this psalm that we're going to look at this morning. You see, the psalm actually starts with this little phrase at the top that's in the text, a song of ascents of Solomon. So he is the writer of this psalm. But what does a guy like Solomon have to resolve? I mean, you think about him. Does he have to resolve to advance his career this year? No, because he had all the power and authority anyone could ever want. You read passages like in the book of 1 Kings chapter 4, you find phrases like this. Solomon ruled over all the kingdoms from the Euphrates to the land of the Philistines and to the border of Egypt. They brought tribute and served Solomon. So he doesn't have to resolve to have more power or more authority. He already had it. Well, maybe Solomon has to resolve to be more educated. I mean, maybe he needs to get another degree or get accepted to graduate school. Do you think he had to resolve that? No. Because here's this guy who has more wisdom than all of us combined, than we will ever have. It says in 1 Kings 4, God gave Solomon wisdom and understanding beyond measure, and breadth of mind like the sand of the seashore, so that Solomon's wisdom surpassed the wisdom of all the people of the East and all the wisdom of Egypt. What does a guy like Solomon resolve to do? Does he resolve to be more famous? No, everybody already knew about his renown. It says in 1 Kings 4, his fame was in all the surrounding nations. All the nations came to hear the wisdom of Solomon from all the kings of the earth who had heard of his wisdom. He doesn't need fame. He doesn't need wisdom. He doesn't need to advance his career. He doesn't need to acquire things. He doesn't need to amass money. Why? Because he already had all that. It says in the book of 1 Kings, he made silver to be like the stones in Jerusalem. I mean, he just was amassing wealth. Anything Solomon wanted, that's what he already had. So what does a guy like Solomon do? Well, maybe it's relationships. No, he didn't need that either. Anyone who's read anything about Solomon, you know, he had 700 wives who were princesses. And listen, if you got one walking around with princess on it, I mean, you know you got your hands full. But he had 700 of them. 700 princesses and 300 concubines. What does a guy like Solomon resolve to do? I want to suggest that he makes a resolution in Psalm 127. And I think it's one that all of us should listen to. Because, you see, Solomon came to this conclusion. Although he had all the success and all of this stuff, he was missing something. You see, deep down in his heart, he felt empty and unfulfilled. And so right from the start, I just want to warn you. If you're making these resolutions and you're making these plans and you're mapping things out for 2015 and you're filling your life full, I just want to warn you, there's a difference between a life that's filled full and a life that's fulfilled. There's a difference. You may be planning this year to fill your life full of work or full of sports or full of school or full of family or full of ministry endeavors or full of future plans or full of relationships, but there's a difference between a life that's filled full and a life that's fulfilled. You see, all of your stuff and all of your schedules can be topped off and you can still have a heart that's on E. And that, my friends, is the life of Solomon. A guy whose life, with all the success and all of his stuff, it seemed like, man, everything's packed full. He's got everything. Yeah, but his heart was empty. His life was filled full, but his life was not fulfilled. And so there's a resolution in Psalm 127 that I think he suggests for all of us who don't just want a filled up life, but a fulfilled life. And so what is that? Well, here in this psalm, he looks at three basic endeavors of man. And he shows how God must be involved in every area of our life if we're ever to find fulfillment. God must be involved in all that we do if we're ever going to have lives that are fulfilled. Notice in the first two verses, there's the repetition of Solomon's famous word. Now, Solomon does have a famous word, doesn't he? If you read the book of Ecclesiastes, it's there 37 times. If you read this psalm in just the first two verses, it's there 3 times. Does anyone know his famous word? Vanity. Vanity, futility, emptiness. It's vain. Notice what he says in this passage. He says in verse number 1, Psalm 127:1, unless the Lord builds the house, those who build it labor in vain. Unless the Lord watches over the city, the watchman stays awake in vain. It is in vain that you rise up early and go late to rest, eating the bread of anxious toil, for he gives to his beloved sleep. What Solomon does in this passage is he highlights three basic endeavors of man and shows how God must be involved in every area of our life. I want to tell you something. This psalm is a very special passage to me. And I want to share it with you this morning because I came to a point in my life a number of years ago where I felt like my life was filled up with stuff. I had a busy schedule. I was doing lots of ministry endeavors and I was chugging along, but I just didn't feel like my life was fulfilled. It's like when you lay in bed and you're on vacation and you don't have any work to do and it's done and it's accomplished and it's quiet and you just sit there, surrounded by nothing but darkness and silence, and you think about life, and you begin to ask yourself, am I really fulfilled? Am I really satisfied? Is what I'm doing, does it really have meaning? Is it really meeting my need? Is my heart really full? Or am I just busy? Is it just this frenetic scurry of stuff? Is it just this rat race over and over and over, this endless cycle? Am I just weary from all the things that have filled my life, but I'm not fulfilled? And so I got to a place in my life where this passage spoke loudly to my heart because I didn't want to live a rat race. I didn't want to have a life that was just filled full. I wanted a life that was fulfilled. And what God taught me in this passage and what I want to share with you this morning is that if you're going to have fulfillment, you must include God in every ambition of life. Everything. He must be woven into the fabric of everything you do. And so here in this passage, Solomon highlights the first thing. It has to do with building. You see that? Unless the Lord builds the house, those who build it labor in vain. The first thing that Solomon says here is that building is meaningless unless God is in it. Building is meaningless unless God is in it. He says, unless the Lord builds the house. Well, a house was a dwelling place. It was a structure. Sometimes it referred to a family, like your household, or a kingdom, or a dynasty. Unless the Lord builds this, it's meaningless. It's vain. You know, I think about our lives, and in most of us, we have a wiring that's set to build something. I mean, we want to construct something. We want to bring some measure of control, or we want to impose order on life. I mean, all of us are probably aimed somewhere to build something. We want to build a career or build a business or build a bank account or build a retirement fund or build an education or build a future or build a family or build a marriage. You're building. But Solomon is saying here that unless the Lord is involved in that, then all of those building endeavors are actually meaningless. So here we have in our heart this directive, like I want to do something that lasts. I want to build something that is permanent. I mean, how many of you just get tired? Like, is your big goal this year to wash the dishes? I'm going to wash the dishes this year. Or how about this one? I'm going to mow the lawn this year. I'm going to do the laundry this year. I mean, are those your big ambitions? No, they really aren't. And do you know why? Because those things, you do them, and then what do you have to do? You have to do them again, and then you have to do them again. Boy, my goal this year is to have a paycheck. Yeah, well, every paycheck seems to get used by the end of the month, doesn't it? So when we talk about building, it's something beyond the mundane. It's something beyond this revolving door of stuff that has to just be redone. We want to put some order into life. We want to construct something, complete something, control something. But here he says, unless the Lord is involved in those things, then it's going to be meaningless. Now, why is that? Well, it's because God is the ultimate builder. I mean, think about what God has built. Think about what God has constructed. You get to passages like Isaiah 48:13. This is God speaking. He says this, "My hand laid the foundation of the earth. My right hand spread out the heavens. When I call to them, they stand forth together." Think about God. He is the ultimate builder. I mean, he just used his hands and he built the foundations of the world. He used his other hand, he drew all the stars. I mean, he is the ultimate builder. Why is it that we in our lives are seeking to build things without his help? Why have we forgotten about him? Why have we partitioned him out of the building projects of our life? You see, Solomon had spent many years of his life building things without God. Do you remember some of the things Solomon built? I mean, he built the temple. He built his own palace. He built walls and he built fortresses. He built a naval fleet. He built cities. He built storehouses. He built stables. You see all this in 1 Kings 15 through 19. He built all these things. But he comes to this conclusion. the material list of every meaningful building project must include God. You see, whatever it is that you're seeking to build this year, God must be in it if there's going to be any meaning to your building. So let me ask you, what are your ambitions this year? What are your goals? What are your checklists? What are you trying to acquire or achieve? What is your building project? And then let me ask you this, is God on the materials list? See, because building is meaningless unless God is in it. My friends, pity the person who builds without God. Pity that person. You see, you can build things without God. You can do it. But they're just existent. You see, you can build a house without God and it exists. But when God is in it, it's not just existent, it's significant. You can build a church, but if God is in it, it's not just existent, it's significant. You can build a career, but that's just existent. If God is in it, it is significant. And so I plead with you at the beginning of 2015, build God into every area of your life. Building finds meaning. Building finds fulfillment only in God. Sometimes I think our lives are filled with all this construction. And yet if we were to look past the veneer, if we were able to see past the outside, we'd see that something's missing. There's just an emptiness. There's no God there. Christmas cards are kind of going out of vogue for people my age. I mean, I think we got maybe 12, 15 of them, maybe 20 this year. I mean, there were years when I was a kid, I remember, and maybe you remember this too, in my mom's house, I mean, there were probably 100 plus. She would hang them on the wall, fill the wall. Well, a number of years ago, we did receive an amazing Christmas card. I mean, it was one of these, it was back when, has anyone here heard of stamping up? It's a thing of the past now with the computers. No one has ever heard of it. So me and Garrett, thanks. Stamping up buddies. It's kind of like scrapbooking. I don't know. There was this fad where women did this. It was called stamping up. You had stamps and little, I don't know, things and gadgets and gizmos and grommets. And I mean, we got this card. And this card, I'll never forget it. It had like three-dimensional designs, fine textured paper, frames around it, glossy stars, spacer size stamps, all of this stuff. I mean, it was an incredible card. Never seen anything like it. And you grab this card, and you're like, woo-doo-doo. And you open it up. I mean, all this work. You open it up, and there's two names scribbled at the bottom. I remember thinking to myself, this person handcrafted this card for hours. Amazing outside. I mean, spacers and layers and incredible art project. And you open it up and there's nothing. And you think to yourself, maybe they should have spent a little more time writing a note instead of dressing up the outside. And then we stop and we think about our own lives. And how much time we're spending building, 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 building all this stuff. And God opens it up and looks inside. And for some of us, there's just emptiness there. Because we have not built God into the endeavors of our lives. A whole lot of work on the outside, but very little on the inside. And what Solomon is saying in the beginning of Psalm 121 is that if you go about laboring and building things that way, it's in vain. It's a waste. What a tragedy if we would look back on all of our life's work only to discover that it's a waste, that it's vain, futile, worthless. It's interesting to me as you read through the pages of Scripture, you find building projects, ones that don't have God in them, and you see what a waste they are. I mean, think about this one from Genesis chapter 11. Do you remember that building project? I mean, all the peoples of the earth are gathering in the plain of Shinar. They're going to build themselves a ziggurat that reaches to heaven. It's called Babel. Do you remember that? Oh, we're going to build. It's going to be amazing. Build it, build it. Work together, all of us. Build, build, build. There was no God in it. And what happened? It was all a waste. He confused their tongues before they finished the project. What a waste, what vanity if you're working on building but God isn't with you. How about this building project? It's in Matthew chapter 7. There's a man there who constructs a house. But he's not too worried about the foundation. He finds a nice flat piece of sand. Oh, this will be great. Beachfront property. Wonderful. And he constructs this wonderful house. And while he's standing there and his buttons are about to burst and his nose is up in the air after all he's constructed, a wave comes in and erodes the foundation and it's gone. Because the foolish man built his house on the sand. It was a foundation that didn't include God. What a waste. What vanity. What futility. How about the man in Luke chapter 12, another builder? Someone who built without God. He's referred to, how would you like to have your legacy? The reference to you for the end of days is the rich fool. How would you like that to be your legacy? Yeah, that's me. I'm Luke 12, the rich fool. That's what he's called, the rich fool. Here's this guy, he's got all these crops, and things are going crazy. His business is booming. Talk about an agricultural year to remember. Everything's coming in. He doesn't even have big enough barns to keep all the product that his business is making. So he says to himself, self, I will build bigger barns, and then I will store up my goods. I will eat, drink, and what's the last one? And be merry. But the rest of that passage says, God speaks to him and says, you fool, for you are rich in this world's goods, but you are poor towards God. All of this building, and what happened? His life was required of him. Wouldn't it be a tragedy to spend your whole life building something without God and you die before you ever enjoy it? Do you know there are a great many people who do that? What a waste. Solomon says, what vanity. Perhaps you build things. You spend all your life. But it ends up being a house of tragedy. You see people and it's pitiable. They have this house that they've planned themselves. Years and years of work. It's got extravagant furniture and plush carpets. There are pets that roam around in that house with better grooming than you and me. That's the type of place these people have. But amidst all of these niceties, there's a hollow absence of God. You see parents who dislike their kids and kids who hate their parents. You see husbands and wives who cohabitate underneath the same house, but they don't love each other. Oh, they've built. Hey, great home in the city, in the suburbs. Great job. You built what you always wanted, but it's a house of tragedy because God's not in it. You find churches that way too. I've been in churches with plush white carpet. You say white carpet? Yeah, I've been in them. These buildings, gold edging, tall steeples, but an echo of vacancy. Because God is not there. My friends, we can build, but it's all a waste unless God is in it. You see, no matter how hard we work to build anything, fulfillment and enjoyment and significance directly depend upon the involvement of God. He must be woven in to the fabric of our lives. He must make the material list of every building project that we endeavor. Now, when you think about this principle, when you think about it, doesn't it explain much of what you see around you? Doesn't it explain some of the dismay and sadness, some of the disappointment and futility in the world around you? And perhaps even at times of your own heart? You see people and they're spending their life building things, but there's no God and it just doesn't satisfy. It's just not fulfilling. Or maybe in your own life, that's what you've been doing. You're going after and you're going after and you're pursuing and you're trying to get and amass and acquire and achieve, but it just doesn't satisfy. It just doesn't make it for you. Why is that? Because God must be involved if there's going to be fulfillment and enjoyment and significance. You see, all these buildings of man, when God is not involved, those buildings are deceptive. They're deceptive because they have a glitz and they have some glamour, but there is no God. There's a beauty and an attractiveness and an admiration for these things, but they're empty without the Lord. My friends, cities don't work. Families don't function. Careers cap out prematurely, and dollar bills leave you empty if God is not involved. So Solomon says this, don't build monuments of futility. You see, building is meaningless unless God is in it. But he goes on, because he's not just going to talk about building. That's one of our great ambitions in life. But he goes on and he talks about guarding. And what he's going to say next in the passage is that guarding is futile unless God is in it. So building is meaningless. Guarding is futile unless God is in it. Notice what he says in verse 1, the second half of the verse. Unless the Lord watches over the city, the watchman stays awake in vain. Now, we have radars, and we have circling F-16s, and we have some F-22s somewhere over the ocean, and I mean, they're doing their stuff, right, and they're guarding and protecting. But back in the days when Solomon lived, they built walls, they posted sentries, and they had watchmen. Their job was simply to watch. They watched the horizon. They watched for movement through the night. They watched for enemy attacks. They were the watchmen. They were supposed to guard the city. They were supposed to give warning if there was any enemy coming, if there was any danger approaching. And so he says here, unless the Lord is your watchman, and all these other watchmen are staying awake in vain. He's saying, really, guarding is futile unless God is in it. Now, when we think about this, we're saying, well, I don't fly an F-22 and I'm not a watchman. That's not my post. But my friends, don't we have somewhere deep in our heart a desire to protect certain things? A desire to guard certain things? Maybe you're a mom and you're watching out for your kids. Maybe you're a dad and you're seeking to protect your family. Maybe you're a business owner and you're seeking to watch over your business. We all have these instincts to guard and protect. But what Solomon is saying here is that it's futile unless God is in it. I mean, somewhere along the line, we think that protection really depends on us. I mean, if I can just be vigilant enough, if I can watch out for the adversary carefully enough, if I can see who's threatening, if I can keep people close, if I can, but he's saying here, wait, it's really not dependent on you. I mean, at the end of the day, isn't it true that many of our enemies, many of the threats in our life actually come from the shadows? They actually fly under the radar. They actually come from behind us. That's why we have the phrase, I was stabbed in the back. These people that we didn't suspect, these Trojan horses that snuck in. You see, with all of your vigilance and all of your protecting and all of your guarding and all of these things, it's just not going to be enough. Because at the end of the day, you need God. Our enemies dig tunnels. They hide in the shadows. They're camouflaged. They often go unnoticed until it's too late. And what Solomon is saying here, you can give all your effort to guarding and protecting and keeping and watching and all these things, but you need one watchman. It's God. He's the one that can really handle all of the threats of our lives. It's interesting to me, if we would just stop, We're trying to guard our health. We're trying to guard our children. We're trying to guard our marriage. We're trying to guard our job. Oh, I've got to take care of this custody issue. I've got to watch out for my finances in a changing economy. I've got to secure my job position when our company goes through a merger. I've got to watch out for these family members who are, I mean, we go through systems of thought like this. But let me ask you something. Can you really protect yourself from all the threats of life? I still remember this one community. I lived for about 4 years. The first ministry position that I held was in Maryland. And it was a place between Annapolis and Baltimore. And there was a river there called the Severn River. And Pat Sajak had a home. Do you know who Pat Sajak is? What am I, child of the 70s? I mean, what? Come on, Pat Sajak, Wheel of Fortune. I mean, he had a big home on the Severn. I mean, these amazing estates all up and down this river that emptied into the Chesapeake Bay. I mean, that was great. I still remember this one community. It was called The Pod. That's what it was called. The reason I know this community, it was all these wealthy people, Pat Sajak and friends, living down this road, but it had a big gate, a big metal gate to protect it from low-class people, you know, like me. This big gate, and on it said The Pod. I mean, they had cameras. No one's going to get into this entrance to this exclusive community. I mean, they're going to protect from all the vagrants and thieves and all these people. But I thought to myself, you can put up all the cameras you want. You can build all the fences you want and all the gates you want and do all that. But let me just ask you something. Age still sneaks under the fence. Cancer still finds its way through. Drunk drivers are still there, and tragedy still strikes, right? I mean, protect all you want, build all you want, guard all you want, watch all you want, be vigilant all you want, but you can't protect against everything. That's why Solomon is saying here, you need God. In all of your efforts to watch, there's really only one watchman. It is God. Maybe you'll write in your margin if you're accustomed to doing that in your Bible. But Psalm chapter 121, Psalm 121 verse 2 says this, "My help comes from the Lord, who made heaven and earth. He will not let your foot be moved. He who watches," it's the same word here for watchman, "he who watches you will not slumber. Behold, he who watches Israel will neither slumber nor sleep. The Lord is your watchman." It's the same Hebrew word here, your keeper, your watchman. God is the one who's able to truly watch over us. All other efforts are futile. When I was a kid, nearly every summer, we vacationed at a beach in Delaware. My dad had a friend who was an executive banker, and his family owned this home that was on this private beach in Delaware. And so each year they would invite us down and we'd spend a week and we'd go to the beach. We would go, we were homeschooled, which explains a lot of things. We would go after all the kids went back into school, then we would go to the beach, you know, so everybody's gone. And that's when we would go in September and we'd take a week and do this. And I can remember spending hours working on sandcastles. I mean, you know, just try to do the artistry, try to make these spires, these gates, these moats. I mean, all kinds of stuff. And we would just spend hours on this. And the one arch nemesis was the water, the waves, the tide. But we figured it out. I mean, we'll build larger walls up in front. I mean, we took shovels and we took buckets and, I mean, huge walls. We'll build moats. We'll make it so the waves can't come in. And we'll do all of this stuff to protect our sandcastle. But do you know what? Every day when we came back, guess what? The sandcastle was gone. Because do what you will, you can't protect against the tide. My friends, we live in a fallen world, and so guard and watch all you will. But you can't protect against the tide. There's only one watchman who can. His name is God. When we come to grips with this truth, then we're able to live in happy faith instead of anxious anxiety. See, the difference between people and life is not the amount of threats that are against them, It's the amount of faith they have in the true watchman. You know, these people are like bright lights in this world. The ones who have happy faith in God. The ones who trust the Lord to protect. They trust the Lord to take care of these problems. They trust the Lord to handle the financial crisis. They trust the Lord to deal with our foreign enemies. They trust the Lord. They're able to like breathe deeply. Well, many of the rest of us scurry about in frenetic chaos, in worry and anxiety and fear. When many of us are staying up late because our hearts are being gnawed at by anxiety, while they rest in happy faith. My friends, this passage is a call to you and me to let God be the watchman. Let Him take care of these things. He is the sovereign. We live and we breathe and we have our being because of Him. Acts chapter 17. Final responsibility for success or failure, final responsibility for safety or pain isn't dependent on you. It's dependent on God. He is our watchman. He's the ultimate builder. He is the ultimate watchman. And so if we're building without God, it's meaningless. If we're seeking to guard our life without God, it's futile. There's one last thing that Solomon says in this passage. He says, if you're laboring without God, it's worthless. Because you're doing all this work. You rise up early to get into work early. You stay late for some overtime. You're going to work it all out. You're going to figure it all out. No, that's worthless unless God is in it. Notice the text, verse number 2. It is vain that you rise up early and go late to rest, eating the bread of anxious toil. Why? Because He gives to His beloved sleep. Here He's saying you can labor by getting up early. You can labor by staying up late. You can eat the bread of anxious toil. So here you've toiled all day anxiously. You can eat the fruit of that. But it's worthless. It's vain. Because it's God who gives. You know, I think there's some confusion in our society. Some people think that if there's progress, it means that God is at work. As long as there's progress. I mean, we're gonna have more people, we're going to have more product, we're going to have more research, more writing, more business, more money, but is more really the work of God? Is that always how He works? Like if I work more hours, if I just do more, my friends, I mean, think about some people in the Bible. Think about Job. Think about Asaph. Think about Jeremiah. They didn't have more. God did a work of wringing out their life so that they had less. That was God's work. And yet many of us, we rise up early, we go to bed late, we eat the bread of anxious toil because we think if there's more, that's the way life works. I got to have more. That's not always how God works. Sometimes the work of God is seen in the drip or the dwindle of life. I mean, I think about the work of God in Elijah the prophet. You get into the book of 1 Kings, and you see Elijah the prophet, and he's sitting next to this brook called the Brook Kereth. What was God's work? To have him sit there and watch the brook dry up. It's like sitting there and watching grass grow. You just want me to sit here? You want me to get up early to sit here? You want me to stay up late to sit here? No, Elijah, just sit here. I mean, actually, for more than a year, it seems like he just sat there. But that was where God was at work. Or follow that same prophet down to a town called Zarephath, to a widow who had almost nothing. She's got a little bit of oil and just a little bit of flour. She's going to make one last little hand cake and then die in the famine. But God just gave a little bit more and a little bit more. And it was in the drip and it was in the drizzle that God was at work. You see, many of us think, I've got to do more, I've got to do more, I've got to go longer, I've got to have more, I've got to add to this, I've got to get up early, I've got to stay up late, I've got to. Wait. Sometimes God's at work in the drip and the drizzle because progress and more don't always mean the work of God. Some of us have this frenetic busyness. We think busy, that means I'm doing the work of God because I'm busy. Busy doing this, busy doing that, busy around work, busy around family, busy in ministry, busy in sports, and busy, busy, busy. Some people are busy, and they busy themselves to death because when they slow down, they have to face the pain of shallow living and hollow spirituality. So they just stay busy so that they don't have to really think about the state of their own heart. Just flurry around. Just busy yourself. No, stop for a second. Be still. Know God. And here he's talking about someone who in vain rises early, someone who in vain stays up late because they think through all their busyness, through all their progress, they're going to get it done. Oh, my friend, that is vain bread of anxious toil. All of our labor is worthless unless God is in it. The fact of the matter is that God in a thought or a word can do more than we can ever produce in all of our working days. Do you know that's what Jesus actually said to his disciples? In Matthew chapter 6, they're all fretting. What am I going to eat? What am I going to wear? Where am I going to go? What's my life going to be like? Where's my future? He says, would you just stop and look at that flower? Do you remember Jesus saying that? Solomon in all of his glory was not arrayed like one of these. What is Jesus saying there? Listen, in just a thought, I did more for that flower than Solomon did in all of the labors of his life. You eat the bread of anxious toil, rising up early and staying up late and fretting about life, when in reality I can do more in a thought or a word than you could ever do in your entire existence. Laboring is worthless unless God is in it. Psalmist is calling us to be more God-centered in our everyday life. It's tempting to busy ourselves this year, to fill our lives full this year and leave no room for God. But labor is vain unless God is in it. So we get to this point, verses 1 and 2. We're starting to wind some things down. And some of you are wondering, so what exactly are you saying, Lucas? Are you saying that the builder needs to cease from building? Or are you suggesting that the watchman needs to neglect his duty? Or are you saying that people should just trust God and do nothing? No, my friends, that's not at all what I'm saying. That's not what Solomon is saying either. I mean, look through the whole book of Proverbs. Think about all the times he calls us to be laborers and workers and not sluggards, right? He's not telling you just to walk away and quit everything and say, well, just trust God. I mean, he's got it all. No. What Solomon is calling us to do is to do all that we can do, but then never fix our trust upon it. Because ultimately, it all comes from God. Ultimately, if all I do is going to have any fulfillment, is going to have any significance, is going to have any meaning, then God must be part of it. And so here in this passage, I think perhaps the most shocking thing that we see here is not that your life is going to go poorly if you don't involve God in your life. I mean, that's not shocking to us. If you leave God off the material list, if you don't put him in the ingredients of life, then things aren't just going to, they're just not going to turn out. I don't think that's shocking. Do you want to know what really is shocking when we look at this text? It's that God actually wants to be involved in our lives. Like, he actually wants to be part of our building. He actually wants to be part of our gardening. He actually wants to be part of our working. God wants to be intricately involved, personally, intimately involved in your life. And that, my friend, is shocking. Why in the world would God ever want to do that? Well, look at the last phrase of verse 2. It's because you're beloved. Do you see that? It's because he loves you. He gives to his beloved. God loves you enough to be involved in your life. Will you welcome him? And I just want to say this. There are some really interesting things in the close of this chapter that I must tell you about. That little phrase there, he gives to his beloved sleep, it could be perhaps more appropriately translated, he gives to his beloved in their sleep. Literally while they're sleeping. Say, while they're sleeping. I mean, when I'm sleeping, I'm not doing anything. Exactly.
When you're sleeping, you have no part in it. You can take no glory for it. And God just works. You wake up in the morning, you're like, what? Look at what he has done. God gives to his beloved in their sleep. Now, what's even more amazing about this text is about who wrote it. Remember, it's written, do you see right at the top where it says Psalm 127? And it says a little phrase right there. It's written by whom? Solomon. Who is Solomon? Well, he had a nickname. Do you know Solomon's nickname? It wasn't Saul, Solly. No, that's not it. Solomon had a nickname. It's in 2 Samuel chapter 12, verse 24. Then David comforted his wife Bathsheba, went into her, lay with her, and she bare a son. And he called his name Solomon. And listen to this. And the Lord loved Solomon and sent a message by Nathan the prophet. So he called his name, here's his nickname, Jedidiah. What does Jedidiah mean in Hebrew? Jedid, beloved. Yahweh, the beloved of God. Jedidiah. That was Solomon's nickname. Jedidiah, the Jedid of Yahweh, the beloved of God. Now listen to this phrase. He gives to his beloved, his Jedid, in their sleep. How did God give to Jedidiah in his sleep? I mean, just rack your brain. What did Solomon want most? What did Solomon need most? And when did he get it? He needed and wanted wisdom. Remember, God says, I'll give you one thing. How did God come to him? It says he came to him in a dream while he slept at night. And God gave him the thing he needed most and wanted most. He gave to his Jedidiah in his sleep. He gave him wisdom. And my friends, that's what he actually does for you and me. He gives to us when we have no partnership in it, we have no participation in it. It's just all glory to him. All right, I'm going to build. All right, watch. I'm going to guard you. Wait. I'm going to work this out for you so that he gets glory. God gives to his beloved while they sleep. And so Solomon closes with an illustration that's really an admonition. He says, behold, children are a heritage from the Lord. The fruit of the womb, a reward. Now, some people have looked at this passage, and they've looked at this passage like it's a call to have many, many children. Like arrows in the hand of a warrior, verse 4. Are the children of one's youth. Verse 5, blessed is the man who fills his quiver full of them. And go buy a 15-pack van. Fill your quiver. Have lots of children. And he ends that way. That's not actually what he's really doing here. He's giving an illustration that's actually an admonition. And walk with me as I close through this illustration. This whole time, Solomon has been saying this. He's been saying, listen, if you're going to build, you need to have God. If you're going to watch, you need to have God. If you're going to work, you need to have God. At the end of the day, you need to trust God because God gives to his beloved, right? That's what he's been saying this whole time. And then he goes off on this kid thing. God gives his beloved in their sleep. And then talking about kids, let me ask you something. He says this, kids are a reward. They're a blessing. They're a gift that comes from God. And they come when a man and a woman sleep together. I'm not going to break down the euphemism, but you get it. God does that. It's a reward. It's a gift. It's a work of God. I mean, if you wonder about that, ask someone named Sarah or someone named Elizabeth. Ask someone named Hannah. Are children really from God? Yes. They're given when people sleep together. See, do you see the link? Do you see how he's linking this? And then he's saying, happy, blessed, fulfilled is the one who has their quiver full of them. Let me put it this way. It's almost idiomatic of the entire psalm. Happy is the person whose life is filled up with that in which God has been involved. Happy is the person whose life is filled up with that which gives true fulfillment. Literally, the work of God. Happy is that person. And so through this whole psalm, Solomon has really been saying, happy is the man who is filled full with building endeavors where God is involved. Happy is the man who's filled full with guarding endeavors where God is involved. Happy is the man who's filled full with laboring endeavors where God is involved, because only there is fulfillment. Happy is that person. So my friends, as we think about 2015, we think about building and guarding and laboring. Are we going to have God involved? Because if we do, we'll find fulfillment instead of futility.